Freedom alert! Freedom alert! Freedom alert! This is Radio Freedom.
You can listen to this show anytime at www.freedomsite.org. This is Alternative Forum 2000.
This is Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom in Washington, D.C., and I'm interviewing a controversial author and lecturer who has visited Canada a number of occasions. I'm talking with Eustace Mullins. Mr. Mullins, welcome to Radio Freedom.
I'm very glad to be on your show, and I hope we'll have some interesting points to make.
Mr. Mullins, you made your original reputation as a man who interviewed Ezra Pound and wrote a very well-received biography of his. Can you tell us how you met Ezra Pound and what your impressions were?
Yes, I came to Washington to go to art school because my university, Washington Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, did not have an art department at that time. They do now, but this was many years ago. So I came here and went to this art school, and one of my teachers there had been visiting Ezra Pound. He and his wife both came out once a week, and they were helping Pound to translate modern French poetry, particularly Mallarmé. And so they asked me to come and visit Ezra, and I didn't see the point of it because I thought, what would I talk to Ezra Pound about? I didn't realize he'd do most of the talking, so it was no problem at all. And I finally came out and visited him, and we hit it off, and I started coming out. Eventually, I came every day for 3 years.
Ezra Pound, of course, is by many people regarded as probably the greatest English poet of the 20th century. Was Ezra Pound living in Washington at this time, or what were his circumstances?
Ezra Pound was a political prisoner and was described as a political prisoner by the staff at St. Elizabeth's Hospital here in Washington, where he was held at that time in a barred cell. And so he was there on charges of treason, which had been brought by Alger Hiss, who certainly knew treason when he saw it.
Being a communist agent himself.
A KGB agent, definitely. And, well, Roosevelt's three personal assistants at that time were all three KGB agents, and they were Alger Hiss and Lachlan Curry and Harry Dexter White, who was the protege of Henry Morgenthau, one of Roosevelt's closest confidants and Secretary of the Treasury at that time.
So your initial interest in Ezra Pound was literary. Is he the man who got you interested in politics?
Well, Ezra, I didn't know it when I first went out there, but Ezra talked politics to anyone who would come out because he was well on his way. He had been, for 3 years, had been held as a political prisoner without trial. He was eventually held for 13 and a half years without trial, which is a record in the United States for someone being held without trial the longest period of time.
So what did you learn from Pound politically?
Politically, I learned that the communists were an evil influence. He'd been very anti-communist all of his life after he went to Europe. He left this country at a fairly young age, and when he got to Europe, he found that the greatest enemies of civilization were the communists, and so he became very anti-communist and remained so all his life.
So I understand that Pound, even in some of his poetry, took quite an interest in the creation of money and the banking system, and that's what initially attracted him to Italy and to Mussolini. Did he discuss the creation of money with you?
Oh, yes, because what Pound found out about the communists, the strange thing was that they were supposed to be anti-capitalist and supported by the workers and peasants all over the world. And he discovered that the only people who supported communism were the bankers themselves, and that the workers and peasants really never liked the Communist Party, because first of all, it was dictatorial, and that in most countries, communism succeeded only by force. In other words, there was never a rising of the workers and peasants in any country in the world to install a communist government. It was always superimposed by bankers and by their hirelings, the mercenary armies.
When did you write your book on Ezra Pound?
First he had me research the book on the Federal Reserve System, which was more important, and I spent 3 years on that book, and it was published in 1953.
Could you give us a brief summary of your argument about the Federal Reserve System?
Well, my book was researched at the Library of Congress here in Washington with Ezra's daily supervision, because obviously it was a subject I had never heard of, and Ezra guided me on doing my research, and eventually the book, as published, was the result of many volumes of official congressional hearings, which were held from time to time about the Federal Reserve System by Congress. And this meant that my entire book was based on official government documents. In other words, there was no opinion from me or any conclusions which I drew. I was simply a journalist researching government documents.
And what did you discover about the Federal Reserve System, which was founded in America in 1913?
My initial discovery, I was only in this subject a short time. I found out it was the result of a huge conspiracy. And in fact, the initial book was published on Ezra's advice with the title Mullins on the Federal Reserve. He wanted it to be a definitive treatment, so that's why he chose that title. And then later on, I republished it as the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, because it definitely was a conspiracy. And I got the documentation on this in the stacks of the Library of Congress. I found some rare books in the Library of Congress which recounted the story of a secret meeting at Jekyll Island, Georgia, at the Millionaires Club in Thanksgiving week of 1910. And this reportage of this only was published in 1916 by Current Biography of December 1916. And this was the story of a secret meeting of bankers, and the author of this article, by the way, was the leading financial reporter at that time named B.C. Forbes, who later founded Forbes magazine, and his son Malcolm inherited the magazine. And so I wrote to Malcolm Forbes about 20 years ago, and I suggested that he give his father credit for the greatest scoop in financial writing ever known, which was the expose of the Jekyll Island meeting, which resulted in the Federal Reserve Act. And he never responded, of course.
This is Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom. I'm in Washington talking with author and lecturer Eustace Mullins. Mr. Mullins, we frequently, those of us who get our news from CNN, hear about the endless wisdom of the Federal Reserve System and Alan Greenspan, who's fine-tuning the American economy. If a layman were to ask you, well, what's wrong with the Federal Reserve System, what is wrong with it?
Well, you know, in my lectures around the world on the Federal Reserve System and banking, quite often I get the question from someone in the audience, well, what would you replace the Federal Reserve System with? And my answer has always been the same. I say, well, what would you replace the mafia with? Because it's the same thing. It's a gang of robbers. I call it the Federal Robbery System. And I call the Internal Revenue Service, which is an adjunct of the Federal Reserve Act itself, I call it the Internal Robbery System. Because we're talking now about robbery, but it's not a robbery of a few individuals or a large number of individuals. It's a universal robbery, not only of the American people, but of Canada and every country that has a central bank. These central bankers are robbing entire populations, and there's a lot of resentment. There is criticism of the central banks in Europe and Asia, but not in the United States.
Well, how does the central bank, or in the case of America, the Federal Reserve, rob people?
First of all, they get a government license to print money. A central bank is a bank of issue. A bank of issue simply means a bank which has a license to print money. Now, governments traditionally printed their own money, because, as Ezra Pound told me quite early on in our association, the two powers of sovereignty, which define sovereignty in any country, are the right to issue money and the right to control foreign policy. And of course, in the United States, we don't have any either of those rights, and you probably don't have them in Canada also, because the American, the people in Canada and the United States have no right to sovereignty by printing their own money, and they have no control whatsoever of foreign policy, which is carried out strictly by the central bankers who control foreign policy.
So are you saying then that the Federal Reserve is not controlled by the government?
One of the first things I found out about the Federal Reserve, which astounded me and which many people still refuse to believe, is the government of the United States has never owned a single share of the stock of the Federal Reserve banks.
So the president appoints the chairman and the board, but the U.S. government does not actually control the Federal Reserve?
They have no control whatsoever. In fact, when the bankers put through the privately owned Federal Reserve Act in 1913 by subterfuge, passing it during the Christmas vacation when most of the opponents of this bill had gone back to the West and Midwest, which those days was a three-day trip, and it had been traditional in Congress to postpone important legislation until after the Christmas recess. And what they did, as soon as the congressman left, Congressman Charles Lindbergh of Minnesota had led the opposition in Congress to the Federal Reserve Act. And as soon as they departed Washington, they hurriedly called Congress together, and they had a quorum. They were very sure to have a quorum, which meant they had enough people to authorize it. They had just enough. And they passed the act on December 23rd, of 1913, and even the New York Times pointed out at that time, never has legislation of such importance been passed under these very unusual circumstances, and never again since has such legislation been passed under those circumstances.
Well, back to the question of how the Federal Reserve is a privately owned organization owned by American bankers.
The definition of a central bank, which I have more or less had to define over the years because there is no economic literature which defines a central bank. It is not taught in any college. You cannot take economics at any major college and find out what a central bank is because they don't want anyone to know. And a central bank, first of all, is a bank of issue which has a license to print money. Second, it's privately owned. And third, its biggest job is war finance. In other words, the central banks are set up to promote war.
So what is the difference then between an enterprising person with a good photocopier printing currency and the Federal Reserve?
Well, the Federal Reserve has a government license to print money. And in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, we had the government, U.S. government, has a cabinet post called Department of the Treasury and a Secretary of the Treasury. Well, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 superseded the Treasury by naming the Federal Reserve System as the fiscal agent of the entire United States government. That was included in the act to give them final power. And the Department of the Treasury then became really an adjunct of the privately owned Federal Reserve System.
Does the Federal Reserve, do you see it as a lending institution, creating money and then lending it?
No, it does not lend money. What the Federal Reserve System does, it creates money and sells it to other banks. In other words, the banks which are not part of the Federal Reserve System, independent banks, they have to buy their operating capital from the Federal Reserve System.
And who makes the profit from the sale of this money?
All of the profits go to the private owners, stockholders of the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, we had a gentleman today who was talking about that, and he said that the Federal Reserve System, by law, which was included in the original Federal Reserve Act of 1913, they agreed that they would turn over all of their profits from their transactions, except for 6%, which they would reserve for operating expenses. and that is the law today. Now, the problem with that, which seems very generous, that they would give 94% of all their income to, or profits to, the government, is that they have refused to ever be audited, and the 6% that they spend on expenses is very lavish and includes $5,000 memberships in country club for the officials and so forth, and putting up lavish bank buildings, marble palaces, you know. And so many people, many congressmen, including Congressman Henry Gonzalez, a recent chairman of the Banking and Currency Committee of Congress, have tried to put in bills in Congress to audit the Federal Reserve System, and those bills have always they've failed, with only four or five congressmen voting for them. So they've never even gotten close to getting a vote which would enact that.
Radio Freedom will return after this short message. The quest for equality shows how one fine-sounding idea, equality, has piled up tens of millions of human corpses over the past 200 years, through the terror of the French Revolution to the horrors of 70 years of communism in Russia, China, Cuba, and elsewhere. Those trying to impose equality have killed millions to make the world better, of course. The quest for an impossible equality continues with rank discrimination such as anti-white employment equity or affirmative action measures. Get this brilliant new booklet by Professor Kenneth Hilborn, The Quest for Equality. Send $6 to CFAR at Box 332, Rexdale, Ontario, postal code M9WSL3.
And now back to our feature presentation on the Radio Freedom Network.
Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom. I'm talking to Eustace Mullins, U.S. Lecturer and author. Mr. Mullins, you've been a fairly frequent visitor and lecturer in Canada in recent years, and you've run into some problems in opposition. As you know, Canada's political establishment, especially our militant anti-free speech lobby, largely the Canadian Jewish Congress and the League for Human Rights of B'nai B'rith and operatives of the Communist Party, are no great lovers a free discussion or free speech. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about some of your recent run-ins with the dark forces of repression?
Well, I had always been received very enthusiastically in Canada by audiences which were very anxious to learn the background of the secret banking conspiracies. And but this took a dramatic turn a few months ago when I was asked to appear in British Columbia at Vernon in court to testify on behalf of a Canadian citizen who was accused by Canada Revenue of not paying as much money as they would have liked for him to pay. And he was more or less privately engaged, self-employed as a logger and raising cattle. And so they came after him and wanted to extort money from him, which is their usual method. They don't come to you and say, well, we think you should pay a little more money. You didn't pay as much as you ought to. They come at you with extortion and force, just as they do in the United States, and demanded quite a large sum from him. And this is a working man with a large family. And he told them he didn't owe this money. So he's been now for 2 years has been harassed by the Canada Revenue. So his attorney called me and said, Eustace, would you come to British Columbia and testify in court for this man about the central banking system? And I said, well, I don't think they'd allow me to testify, but I'm certainly willing to help him if I can. And sure enough, when I got up there, the Crown Prosecutor, we went to court, and the Crown Prosecutor said, well, we are dubious about Mr. Mullins' credentials. And this attorney, he's a paralegal, not a practicing member of the bar, which you allow in Canada. Now, they won't allow that in the United States. We don't have much freedom here either. And you're only allowed to represent yourself in a court, but you cannot represent anyone else. And so up there they have paralegals who can appear. This gentleman appeared, and so when the Crown Prosecutor challenged my qualifications, I had my book on the Federal Reserve System right there, a published hard-bound book, which is usually enough to satisfy a court. But the Crown Prosecutor said, well, we challenge his credentials. And then this paralegal said, well, Mr. Mullins is qualified because he is the world's leading expert on central bank. And I didn't know he was going to say that. It's more or less true, but I've never introduced myself that way. So when he said this, the judge accepted it, and the Crown Prosecutor not only accepted it, but refused to cross-examine me during several hours of testimony because he knew he was in over his head, and he chose not to cross-examine at all. And I was looking forward to cross-examination because I like nothing better than to have a lawyer try to trip me up. After 50 years of specializing in the subject, I'm usually ready for anything. And of course, this Crown Prosecutor probably didn't even know the name of his own bank, much less how central banks work. So he was a sitting duck. And from then on, this paralegal cross-examined me, and he asked me at one point, he said, have you ever known in your researches of a central bank which benefited the people of any country in which it operated? And I said, no, in my researches I have never found that it offered any benefits. In fact, it's been an ongoing disaster in every country where a central bank has operated. And of course, my principal explanation for that was the Bank of England. The Bank of England, which was organized in 1694, was backed by the monarchy, and it was the leading dukes of England who bought the stock. Then the Amsterdam bankers, who had put William III of Orange on the throne of England by subterfuge, they did it in a real banker's way. It was called the Glorious Revolution when William of Orange supplanted James II, the king of rightful king of England. And this was done by the bankers bribing James II's admirals and generals, so that when William sailed for England from Amsterdam with a mere 1,200 troops, the opposition had decamped, leaving James alone, and he had to flee. And that's how there was never a battle fired, no shot fired, because they simply bribed all the admirals and generals, including the Churchills, who was Churchill at that time was James II's chief of staff of the army. And he was one of the ones who took the bribes, and this was part of the foundation of the Churchill Duke of Marlborough fortune, which is still intact today. And so William became king of England on the condition that he set up a central bank in England, which he did. He came in 1688, that was a glorious revolution, which is still celebrated in English history, and in 1694 he granted the charter of the Bank of England. And as I say, the dukes and the British royal family and Amsterdam bankers bought the stock. And of course they've held on to the stock because it was very profitable. And the interesting historical side note of that is that England, up till 1694, had the usual civil wars, rebellions, and so forth, which European countries had. After 1694, England has never had a civil war or revolution because the Bank of England, like any central bank, has such total control of the entire resources of the country, all the money, that no one has any money to start a civil war or revolution. And so England has enjoyed internal peace since 1694 because of the Bank of England, a central bank.
Well, after your testimony, which I'm sure the Canadian authorities weren't too happy about, you began to run into trouble.
The word went out, stop this guy by any means. In fact, as I say, I never had any problem. People had said to me, Eustace, how do you get into Canada? I said, I just fly in and show my passport, and that's it. And the fact is that my testimony on the central bank, which is in the official court records of Vernon, British Columbia, was so damaging and had never been produced in court anywhere in the world was so damaging that the Crown has done nothing further with this supposed tax evader, and apparently they're not going to proceed against him any further. I was told that, and I was very happy because I didn't know. I didn't know, first of all, if I'd be allowed to testify. Second, whether, see, there was no jury. It was just a judge. And I thought, well, any judge can be bought by the central bank, so I don't think it's going to help him very much. But I was surprised a few months later, speaking at a meeting in Bahamas, which was mostly Canadian people, for this meeting, that they had made no proceedings against him whatsoever, and the whole thing was in limbo, which apparently meant that they'll never do anything more to him. So I was very encouraged by that, because to help someone in that circumstance who's a victim of extortion and force, I think is very good. Anyway, the word went out, no more talks by Eustace Mullins in Canada, and I began to have this organized opposition, which was composed principally of two very radical groups. One was the Green Party of Canada, which I have never had any contact with in my life, and the other, which was the real force behind it, was Edgar Bronfman, head of the World Zionist Organization, and the Canadian Jewish Congress in Toronto, which was a subsidiary of his group. And they began to inaugurate enormous press campaigns against me with stories, also radio talk shows, TV talk shows in Toronto and Montreal. They were absolutely saturated with material denouncing me as an international danger who should not only be not allowed to come to Canada, but shouldn't go anywhere. And this has continued to the present time.
So you were able to save at least one tax serf from a fiscal lashing, and that's always to the good. It seems to me that not long after the Vernon, your Vernon testimony in Vernon, you were to address an alternative health conference in Toronto. Oh, yes. What happened prior to that?
The alternative health conference by a friend of mine, Libby Gardon. She had a health store, and this group, which she had held these conferences for 15 or 20 years in Toronto, had been very well attended. And she had asked me several times, would I please come? Hers were always held in March, mid-March, and usually I had other engagements at that time. So this year, 2001, I did not have any engagements at the time, and I agreed to come and speak at her meeting, thinking absolutely nothing of it because I had not had any opposition in Canada at all. So she sent out flyers saying Eustace Mullins is coming to speak. Well, when these flyers went out, this whole nationwide organization, international group actually, swung into attack me and claiming that I was a very dangerous person and that I was a Holocaust denier and anti-Semitic. And of course, I had never lectured on any of these things and never been quoted as saying anything. And there were no quotes of any kind in these news stories because they couldn't have any quotes. And I even tried to call, the Globe and Mail called me at home. I had returned to Virginia at that time. They called me at home, and this is one of their lead reporters, feature writers, and I talked to him on the phone for 45 minutes, told him all the background of this, and as far as I know, they never printed one word of it.
Reports in the paper, which were front page, were that, as you were saying, you're an anti-Semite, one of the most dangerous anti-Semites in North America. I believe that was attributed to the Canadian Jewish Congress and Bernie Farber, who is the lead pit bull for the Ontario Jewish Congress Pacific, Ontario region, was saying that if the conference didn't cancel you out, he was going to go to Immigration Canada and try to get you banned. What in fact was your topic at that conference? Because the uninitiated reading the newspaper might well draw the conclusion that it was something about World War II.
Well, the Canadian Jewish Congress tried to present me as a person who, even if I lectured on alternative health, I was probably doing this as a subterfuge to attack Jewish people. And they have, over the years, dismissed all of my work as, they say, well, Eustace Mullins disguises his attacks on Jewish people by writing about the Federal Reserve System. Well, in other words, they're saying that I don't attack Jewish people at all, but by criticizing the Federal Reserve System, I am going around the bend to attack Jewish people. And of course, they've never offered any substantiation. They never offer any substantiation or direct quotes about anything.
It's interesting that that they themselves should make the case that they perhaps have a role or control in the Federal Reserve System or in the banking system, which is not a case you yourself have even made. Anyway, it's been a great pleasure talking with a man who has written about a person I consider one of the very greatest writers of the 20th century, Ezra Pound, a great man, a great human being, and an absolutely incredibly influential poet, Ezra Pound. Mr. Mullins, you offer a wide variety of your books for sale. Could you give our listeners out there in cyberspace your mailing address?
The mailing address for all my books is Bankers Research Institute, Post Office Box 1105, Stanton, Virginia 24401, and the books can be ordered from me. I do have distributors in various parts of the country, but it would probably be simpler just to order them directly from me.
And Mr. Mullins, I hope that it won't be too many more months before you'll find your way back to what was once the great Dominion of Canada and now has become Absurdistan. It's Paul Fromm for Radio Freedom with Eustace Mullins in Washington.
For an audio tape copy of this show and two others of your choice, send a $5 donation to 152 Carlton Street, Suite 545, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Postal code M5A2KO. Don't forget to tune in next week for another thought-provoking broadcast on Radio Freedom.